over to Brian and how it works for
you. Thanks, Joey. What's up, guys? How are we? This is pretty cool. This is pretty badass. Let's have a meeting. My name is Brian Worth. I am alcoholic.
Hey, Brian.
Welcome to the How It Works group. Let's go ahead and start the meeting off with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, and then have the Serenity Prayer. In prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I will now read the open meeting statement. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are glad that you're all here, especially newcomers. In keeping with our singleness of purpose and our third tradition, which states that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking, we ask that all who participate confine their discussions to their problems with alcohol. And I've asked Lee to read the preamble for us. And it's somewhere in here. There you go, homie. Yeah.
My name's Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And this is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Thank you so much, Lee. Next reading, I've asked Greg to read how it works. Right on top.
My name is Greg. I'm a recovered alcoholic and alumni of Any Length Recovery Community. Hey, this is how it works from Chapter 5 of Alcoholics Anonymous, Program of Recovery. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral image. Excuse me. Made a fearless and thorough moral inventory of ourselves, is what it says here. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if He were sought.
Right on. Thank you, Greg. I've asked Nicole to read the 12 traditions. They're somewhere in here.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nicole, and I am an alcoholic. These are the 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such shall never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Excuse me. Is that going to do something?
Testing.
Blow you into it. Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And I got Jay to read the Night Step promises for us.
I'm Jay. I'm an alcoholic. You don't know what this reminds me of. And it's just put a condom on the mic so I can talk to it. I'm Jay. I am an alcoholic. These are the Night Step promises. If we're painstaking, it's funny. If we're painstaking about this phase, and he heard my fist step. If we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
We think not.
They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Thank you so much, Jay. And lastly, we got Joey to introduce our speaker this afternoon.
Hey, I'm Joey. I'm an alcoholic. And just real quick, I was noticing a couple of interesting but kind of humorous points. There's so many people out here and about 200 cars and alcoholics and families, of course, but there's no cops out there writing accident reports. I can see 5 porches from here and nobody's falling backwards off of one of them. And there's probably 35 or 40 mini blinds and I see not one pair of eyes peeking out of them.
Yes!
And my dog's not looking at me telling me the dog catcher's outside. There are a large number of people here, and it took me back when I was sitting thinking about the book, that one of the reasons for the success of AA is the large number of recoveries in reunited homes. And looking at all the families out here, and I'm a crier, so I'm not really going to apologize. Anyway, the guy that's going to come up here and talk, first time I heard him, Lisa had his CD. And there's some of them you can listen to and some things that just grab you right off the bat. And then going through the phone trail through AA of tracking down and getting the phone number and talking to him and starting a phone relationship over the last couple of months has been great and very interesting. And you can sense kind of a presence. But then sitting over underneath the tent where he was eating, and you can just sense the presence of a sober man and the presence of God. But from Los Angeles, Adam T.
My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Adam!
I want to first thank you for inviting me to come talk today. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Want to welcome anybody that's new. You know, if you're trying this one more time, if you don't want to be here today, you know, if you think this is all a big misunderstanding. You know, AA wasn't on my to-do list. You know, I didn't get here because I had a bad weekend. You know, like a lot of us, I had a couple of bad decades. And this had to become, for me, a matter of life and death. I'm from Southern California. We have chips for like 30, 60, 90 days. I think they do that all over the country. And, you know, I had so many chips and key tags in AA, I could have played poker with them. It was awful. You know, I recycled through the rooms for 17 years. And I remember one secretary saying, "Give them back." And it was horrific. I thank God for the unconditional love of the old-timers, who told me stuff like, "Don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back and shut up." But you know what? In saying that with love, they also made it very clear to me that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to me. That if and when I was ready, that there was a solution here. And, you know, that was really important for me to know. And if you're new, I mean, for me, there was so much guilt and shame about being a newcomer. You know, I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And what I would do is I would go into your head and look back at myself and think, "What a loser. My goodness, why can't you get this? What's wrong with you?" And I know the old timers were judging me. You know, if you're new, we're judging. Oh, we make bets. We're not that spiritual. Come on, think about it. I love it when they say, "Don't judge anybody in AA." You guys hear that around here?
Yeah.
And then what do they tell you 5 minutes later? Stick with the winners. Think about the contradictions you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember getting out of treatment. I'm in detox, and my counselor says, "Now, Adam, don't make any major changes in your first year." So I come to AA, get a sponsor. What does he tell me? "You got to change everything." Right? "Don't make any major decisions in your first year." You guys seen the third step? We thought well before taking this step. It's a lot of them. "Oh, don't get in a relationship in your first year." No one knows if that works. No one's ever done it. You know, they say we're not saints. There's always a saint in the crowd, right? "Hey, honey, if you got a halo, don't let it choke you." This is AA. But the one I love is God doesn't give us more than we can handle. Think about that statement. If God doesn't give me more than we can handle, then why do I need God's help? about that. Self-reliance. And the longer I've been sober, the longer I've been separated from alcohol, the more I've come to terms with the fact that I absolutely, desperately need God's help. I need your help. If you're new, the hardest thing for me to do is relinquish control, to ask for help, to separate myself from my ego. Help is the dirtiest four-letter word in these rooms. And we were talking about it on the way up here. There's three prayers in this life. One is God help me. It got a lot of us in this facility. One is God give me. It's the greatest distraction on earth. But the prayer you never hear is God use me. And I want to thank you guys for allowing me to come here and share with you. I'm probably the luckiest guy around. You know, at least to me I am. You know. And, you know, there was so much guilt and shame about being a newcomer. Eventually, I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about AA in 2011 is if you see a guy drunk in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting these days, people say stuff like, what's he doing here? Right? Think about it. With the event of treatment, which swoops us up in our most desperate moments, throws us into yoga class, craft hour, nature walks. But what I would do, you know, my keen thinking, we have these late night meetings in LA, you know, 11, 12 at night. We have 2,500 meetings in the greater Los Angeles area. And I'd go to 7-Eleven, get a big gulp cup, fill it up with liquor, put a splash of Coca-Cola on top. Then I'd go to the late night AA meeting, do some of my best sharing. They weren't laughing. Looking for friends. You know, then I started going through treatment centers, and this is not a plug for treatment, but by the time I finally got sober, I'd gone through treatment 28 times.
Oh, God.
Yeah, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood. 28 consecutive times. And I remember telling my sponsor I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would get rid of the guy, you know, loser. Go find someone that's willing. And he looks me right in the eye and he says, you know, Adam, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, no, it means you paid $500,000 for a big book. I wasn't laughing at that either. You know what all the treatment centers and religions have in common, if you really think about it? They all send their drunks to us. You know, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run, but treatment never solved the problem. You know, I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages today out of the big book, but page 101 of the big book says any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. And I have to understand that about treatment, that it may have its rightful place, but in and of itself, it never really solves the problem. It fattened me up for another run, but it wouldn't solve the problem. And I always thought the problem was alcohol. And a friend of mine said, you know, Adam, that bottle of Jack Daniels, that little drink, that little shot glass, that little 12-pack, he said, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then in the very next breath, he says to me, and if you are in fact an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem is an alcohol. And you know, it took me another decade to understand what he was trying to tell me. See, it was obvious I couldn't live with alcohol. I'm that type of drinker. From the time I was in eighth grade, middle school, junior high, everyone could see I couldn't live with alcohol. I'm already pissing in my pants, drooling on my desk, passed out under the bleachers. My nickname's Space Cadet. I'm like 14. I can't find homeroom. It's obvious. This guy can't live with alcohol. You know, I was already in therapy at 11. Everyone can see I can't live with alcohol. But if you're an alcoholic like I am, the greater aspect of this disease, alcoholism, is that I can't live without alcohol. Not successfully, not happily. Alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles.
Yes.
And I have to understand that. And what it really means for me to be an alcoholic, very simply, is that I have a mind that somehow always takes me back to drinking. A mind that always leads me back to alcohol. Very much like gravity. I set up this neural pathway, as therapy wants to talk about, and once I become a pickle, I can never be a cucumber again, no matter how hard I try. I know, it's not a clinical idea. It's pretty basic. But I will fight to prove myself an exception to that rule. I have warped my mind to such a state of destructive drinking. And it will always take me back there. I have a defiant mind. I have a mind that will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Right? And then I'll blame you for eternity. That's why we say denial is an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. And we don't just do it with booze. That's why you can tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell them much. If you don't believe it, start sponsoring somebody. It is critical for me to understand that is part of my personality. That you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you cannot push me into heaven. And until I come to terms with this disease, alcoholism, and the solution on my own terms, nothing can be accomplished for me. And that's why, you know, I talk about some of that humor about the contradictions, you know, in the rooms. And really, there's a difference between the fellowship and the program. And they aren't always in the same place. What I found in the fellowship is I find hope. I find inspiration. But the recovery, the plan of action, the spiritual awakening, the work, I found in the big book with a sponsor. And I think that those things, I really had to understand that difference. And, you know, understanding my denial and my resistance to recovery has a lot to do with that tradition of attraction rather than promotion. And the traditions are really important. That's why we read them. You know, the traditions protect Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what? You want to see some drama? Get between an alcoholic and a drink. You want to see some drama in my life? Get between me and Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I will respect the thing that's saving my life. One of us doesn't work the steps, one of us dies. We don't work the 12 traditions, we all die. The steps stop me from committing suicide. If you haven't noticed, the traditions stop us from committing homicide. You don't believe it? Get involved in a business meeting. Or a committee. You know, one of my home groups, you know, everybody pulls up in their shopping cart and, you know, a lot of low-bottom drunks. And it's really interesting because, you know, we get these people that come in and they want to change everything about our meetings. You know, they want to change the format and the way we run our meetings. And, you know, 2 weeks later, you never see them again. And the longer I've been here... Sound familiar? The longer I've been in AA, the more I want to keep Alcoholics Anonymous exactly the way it is. Because these traditions ensure our survival. I have to really understand that that's important, because for me, like a lot of us, when this becomes a matter of life and death, again, I'm going to start respecting the thing that saves my life. I remember like it was yesterday. I was in one more treatment center. I was dying of alcoholism. I'm going to break tradition. I've been on methadone maintenance for 10 years, okay? Going to a clinic. I was 120 pounds. I looked like I just got out of a concentration camp, you know. I was lost. I was broken. I'd let everybody down one more time. You guys remember. Some of you were just there, right?
Yeah.
And I'm in the detox circle, you know, with my fellow associates. Right? A vision for you. And this woman from AA comes in, you know, on her. We have a thing in the West, because I don't know what you guys call it here, but called hospitals and institutions. And H&I brings meetings into prisons and detoxes and treatment centers, and they have different terminology around the country, but the concept is the same. And this woman is on her H&I panel, and she's doing her AA talk, and she looks us all up and down, and she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I looked at her, and I looked at the guy next to me, and I said, what a bitch. And then she said something that would later change my life. She said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And I understand today, in some ways, if I don't earn it, I don't own it. I have to have a relationship with alcohol. That gift of recovery, just like that gift of surrender or desperation, is personal. If you're new, we can't give you that. That really is the prerequisite for Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the cover charge to get in here. You know, I remember being 20 years old in AA, and the old-timers would say, AA is the most expensive club in the world. Million-dollar program shoved up your butt a nickel at a time. And I was like, yeah, here's to you, Pops. You know, $500,000 later, 28 treatment centers later, I understood what he was talking about. The gift of desperation. It's a great acronym for God, isn't it? There's another one. It's a little harder. It's called grow or die.
Yeah.
And if you're like me, I had to get to a place in my life where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take any more. Then I really understand what it means to be an alcoholic. When I really see what it means to drink against my will. To make all those promises. I'm going to take care of the family. I'm going to finish school. I'm going to show up for you, Mom. I know you got cancer. And not be able to do it. You know, I take so many people through inventory, and I always hear the same thing in that dishonesty. It's not the lies I tell others. It's the lies I tell myself. That lie that my mom's, you know, love for me was more powerful than her disease. That kind of mentality. I could write all day long on step one. Until I'd beaten down that liquor store door over and over and over again at 5 a.m., 6 a.m. Or paid the guy at 7-Eleven $100 for a six-pack because they were closed. Or done a lot of the despicable, diabolical, disgusting things that all of us do on that journey to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You think writing about step one's going to help me? I have to have an experience. I have to see the truth about alcoholism. Now, if you're new, by the way, we're the only people that want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. So glad. glad you joined us today for free lunch. But that's the reality. This is the only place on God's earth where they'll applaud because you came in to save your own life. Feeling heroic. Thanks for gracing us with your presence. I tell people, and I don't mean to be mean because I know I'm going to offend some people today, and I'm sorry, but you know, if you're sitting here today and you really don't want to be here, don't worry about it. You won't be. That's our third tradition, man. I'm sorry. AA was a big step up for me. And it doesn't matter about high bottom, low bottom. We were talking about it on the way up here. You know, Yale to jail, Park Avenue to park bench, the gift of desperation can be the same. Puke smells the same in a Mercedes. But I got to get to that place of hopelessness, of spiritual bankruptcy. I have to see that self-reliance has failed me, that there is nothing else I can do. I can't keep myself sober. So if you're sitting here today thinking about drinking, that beats the hell out of being in a bar right now thinking about getting sober. You're sitting around here waiting for the miracle to happen. Believe me, there's a few moms in here right now that think it's already happened. You're here. I had to bring the body and the mind would follow if I became willing to take action here. I remember when I got sober, my sponsor said, Adam, I want you to buy a black suit. And I said, why? And he said, well, unfortunately, if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to go to a lot of funerals. It's part of the way it is here. Then he said something really nice. He said, and by the way, if you drink again, at least we'll have something nice to bury you in. He was mean. But see, if you baby the alcoholic, you'll bury him. I need to hear the truth about alcoholism. That it's fatal, it's progressive, it's chronic. It's like being on a train, and the train goes to one place. It goes to jails, institutions, and death. That's the only place it goes. Now, if you're new, right now we're at a station. I feel safe, protected. I've been fed, I have some coffee, the heat's off. But see, my experience with powerless doesn't mean I can't drink. It means I will drink again. It means I will get on that train again. And I really don't know where the last exit is. I have to be clear. You know, don't drink no matter what. That's like join Nancy Reagan's Merry Band of Winners and just say no. When everything in my consciousness demands that I stand and deliver, I show up drunk. What's your drug of choice? How about what's your drug of no choice? What's the one I can't say no to? Right? And we throw around jails, institutions, and death like it's a cliche. Come on, that's like hamburgers, fries, and a Coke. They go together. Now, I do a lot of work in treatment, and, you know, I do a lot of H&I, and I go into these facilities, and it's very interesting because if you get into, you know, detox and you start listening and talking to clients and you hear this, there's this foreign language that they speak. It's like a second language. It's called victimese. It usually starts with, I lost everything. I didn't lose anything. It was all drink coupons for me. We live in a world of delusion. One of the things in the big book is it talks about making decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. Real simple, you know. I can't see how the drink bone connects to the jail bone. Right? Right? The meth bone connects to the homeless bone. It's like some... There's some break in the chain of reasoning there. Oh, and we do it with long-term recovery, too. I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. Right? That's called delusion. None of us are immune to that. I knew he was a crackhead. I can't believe he robbed my house. I need to write some more inventory. It is critical that I see that relationship. You know, a lot of us inherit this disease. We look at it in treatment. We see this genogram and how we... But it's not about that. I may not be responsible for how I got it, but I'm responsible for how I treat it. I'm responsible for my recovery. If I wasn't responsible for the stuff I did out there, why do we have a ninth step? You know, and I thought treatment was going to fix me. I had to become willing to take actions here that I didn't believe in. I will say it again and again today. I had to be willing to set aside some old ideas. If you were to add up the three primary relationships and beliefs and attitudes in my life, my relationship with God, my relationship with self, and my relationship with others, and you were to put an equal sign under that, you know what it would equal, right? Detox. And I couldn't see that relationship between my life and my thinking. And it was important for me to understand that idea. Now, I do a lot of H&I. Now, I should, right? I'm an alumni from everywhere, you know? And one of the reasons I talk about that is because of the illustration of surrender. Now, one of the panels that I have is at the Veterans Administration. I'm sure you guys have a VA down here. And, you know, you get into a room like this size full of soldiers, and you start talking about surrender, you know what happens, right? Room gets dead quiet, especially Marines. But, when it, you know, if you ever watch a soldier surrender, the illustration's perfect. You'll see him take the rifle, very slowly lay it on the ground, sit down on the side of the road, wait for someone to tell him what to do, right? When you got 40 AK-47s pointed at your head, you don't throw down the gun with an attitude. Dang it. Huh? And like these court card people, they put their court document in the basket at AA meeting. You sign my card, please. Right? Then they pee all over our bathroom because they're bad. They don't want to be here. You're not sitting on the side of the road looking back at the gun, because if you do, someone's going to shoot you. Am I looking back at alcohol? Am I looking back at the magic that I once found in booze? Is that the lurking reservation that Wilson talks about? Is that the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink? Is that the idea? See, for me, it's like I'm in the high school gym 20 years later. Band's gone, girls are gone, lights are out, and I'm sitting in that dark room all by myself saying, where's the party? Party? There's no disco ball in the dope house. Delusion. A world of delusion. Full flight from reality. For me, it was like a dirty gas station bathroom. But my mind, because life has its moments, I will give my life to recapture those moments. Life has its moments, and for those moments, I will give my life to recapture and recreate the magic that I once found in booze. It's like Oz never gave the Tin Man anything he didn't already have. What am I trying to put in myself that's not already there? And my experience with AA is unless I can find that sense of comfort and ease that I sought from alcohol through this process, there's no way I'm going to stay here. Not for the long haul. You take the booze away from me, you got to give me something better. And that's what this is all about for many of us. You know, there's a direct relationship for me between willingness and surrender. You ever notice that you'll never see anybody more willing to work this program than the guy that comes crawling through the front door after a long, hard run? He'll walk into our meetings and he'll do anything, right? 90 meetings in 90 days. First day out of treatment, he's got three sponsors. Wants to take our whole coffee pot home with him. He don't even have a trunk to put it in, right? We all see that. Probably calling here every day, I need a bed. 30, 60, 90 days later, that same guy's looking me right in the eye saying, you mean we got to go to meetings every day? And like a prize fighter, what I do is I throw in the towel and then I take that towel back one little piece at a time. I take my will back. People that do not recover, it tells you who they are. Am I a cannot or a will not? It is my will that's stopping me from having a great life. It's my will that's preventing me from having freedom, from having joy, from having relationships that work. And I have to see that resistance. I have to look at what it is that's blocking me. In the beginning of this talk, I talked about denial. And if you're new, think about this idea. There's two kinds of denial for someone like me. Denial about the problem. But what's the greater aspect of denial? It's denial about the solution. That these time-tested steps, this plan of action, this design of it, won't work for me. You know, Bill Wilson, by the way, was in Time magazine as being responsible for the largest social movement of the last century. This thing's affected somewhere between 40 to 50 million people. And you know why I think it's not going to work for me? Because it wasn't my idea. Now, I'm not the only self-centered person here. I love it. You know, we say, right, we don't think much of ourselves, but we're all we ever think about. I have to be clear on this idea of willingness and surrender. They are equally proportional. And what happens for someone like me eventually is I become willing to take actions here that I don't believe in. I become willing to set aside these old ideas about self, about others, about God, so I can have a new experience with this thing. I become willing to take these actions. And that really is the idea behind this whole concept. We were talking about it before. You know, in the therapeutic community, there's a science called cognitive behavioral therapy. Guess what? In AA, it's one sentence. You can't think your way into right living, but boy, you can live your way into right thinking. Cost you a dollar. It's pretty interesting. But it's that simple for a lot of us that when I became willing to take these actions that I didn't believe in, and that triangle that we have in AA, recovery, unity, and service, translates